Well, thank you. Thank you, the organizers, for inviting me to give this presentation. Yes, I'm going to talk about mitigation measures to reduce losses of phosphorus during the non-growing season or non-cropping season. And I'm going to give you a northern European perspective. And most of my examples that I'm going to talk about here are from Sweden. Sweden is very far up north. It's 60 degrees. I mean, where Uppsala is, where I work, is 60 degrees north. So we have a very non-growing period. I'm going to, of course, acknowledge all that. There are many people involved in this, and you see some of them here, but there are also others that have contributed to what I'm going to talk about here today. When you talk about the non-cropping period, non-growing period, in relation to phosphorus losses, it's quite easy in Sweden because virtually all of the losses occur during the non-cropping period. This is shown in this example. This is measurements in a catchment which is just south of Uppsala, where our university is, where we do continuous water flow measurements and take water samples for chemical analysis. And we have done that for several years in this catchment. And this happened to be 2015, and as you can see, the blue line, is there a pointer? Yeah, here. Doesn't work. Oh, I don't need it. The blue line there, you can see, that is the water flow measurements. That's drainage and also surface runoff. And if we define the growing season as when the temperature, the daily average temperature exceeds 5 degrees Celsius, we're talking about May, June, July, August, September. The rest is the non-growing period. The water flow during that period in 2015 was 187 millimeters leaving this catchment. And 88%, 22 millimeters was measured during the growing season. So 88% of the water flow in this catchment occurred during the non-growing period. And if you look at the bars, which shows the phosphorus losses, it was 91%. So there's no doubt, if we want to carry out mitigation strategies, we have to have this in mind, that the non-cropping period is very long, and that's when phosphorus losses occur. Just quickly putting it into a historical perspective, this shows average annual temperature from 1860 to 2015. And from that, during that period, the temperature has increased by about 2 degrees Celsius. And that certainly has an effect on the growing period. This is from this is based on measurements in 80 stations in Sweden, spread all over the country. The lower figure shows the cropping period, the length of the cropping period measured in 16 stations in central Sweden. And from 1960 to up until today, or 2015, we have a 2 week longer growing period. And this, of course, taking this into account and going back to the previous figure that I showed you, the longer growing period we have, that probably will reduce phosphorus losses. However, during that period, 1860 to 2015, we also have increased precipitation by about 100 millimeters, and that will certainly increase leaching of or losses of phosphorus. So whatever will be dominant is very hard to say. Anyway, what I'm going to talk about here is based on a large phosphorus program that was carried out in Sweden some years ago that included 24 different projects, all focusing on mitigation practices to reduce phosphorus losses. It had a budget of, it was a three-year project, it had a budget of $4 to $5 million, and we graduated 9 PhD students within this project. So a lot of research came out of this project, no doubt. Structure liming, for example, manure management, soil management, constructed wetlands, precision agriculture to see where the critical source areas are, cover crops, catch crops, to take up phosphorus, buffer strips, and so forth. This is just a small selection of the different projects that we had. As I said, there were 24 of them. And I'm obviously not going to have time to... I'm just going to talk about a few, give you a few examples and put it into a context of a non-growing period. Most of the losses, I would say 70 to 80% of the losses in Sweden occur as tile drainage losses. But during snow melt in spring, we can certainly have surface runoff losses also, but not during the rest of the season, because we have relatively flat land and we also have relatively moderate precipitation. Anyway, we used a high resolution distributed modeling approach to try to see where in this field is 12 hectares large, and it's located very close to the university. We wanted to use the model to predict where the potential erosion pathways would be. And as you see, those black lines are where what the model predicted in this case. This was done in, I think it was fall 2012. The following spring was a spring with a lot of snow, very intensive snow melt, so this occurred. And as you see, the red arrows down there, that's where this ditch is. And it was very well predicted by the model that's exactly where it should occur, according to the model. But talking about mitigation strategies, what do you do to prevent this? Well, I think the only thing would be to use the models to predict where these erosion events would happen, and then have it sort of a permanent ditch with maybe grass-covered sides, and to prevent erosion from occurring. This snowmelt period was only 1 week, and 10 kilo of phosphorus disappeared that time. And that's certainly unacceptable. However, you have to also keep in mind that may happen once in a 10-year period, or maybe once in a 20-year period. So it's not occurring, certainly not every year, but when it occurs, it could be more or less a catastrophe. Something else which is related to water flow rates and so forth is a method that we have tested quite much is constructed wetlands, and I'm going to give you an example from one of them, Bergaholm, which is located, as you can see there, very close to Stockholm. It's a very small wetland. It is only 0.08 hectares, and it's 0.3% of the above catchment. And what we measure here is water flow coming in, water flow going out, and then the retention of phosphorus in this catchment, in this wetland. The wetland consists of a sedimentation pond, 1 meter deep, and a vegetation pond, which is only 0.3 meter deep. If you relate it to high flow rates during the non-cropping period, as you can see on the y-axis, we have the phosphorus load expressed as a kilo phosphorus, particular phosphorus per hectare, and wetland area, and on the retention on the x-axis. If we have high flow rate, high loads of phosphorus coming in, like 200 kilo phosphorus per kilo, 200 kilo particular phosphorus per hectare wetland area, the retention is only 5%. However, if we have a load of 100 kilo phosphorus coming in, particular phosphorus, it could be 35, 40%. So it's definitely related to the flow rate, and also then to the cropping season. When we have snow melt periods, for example, we are more likely having 5% than 30%. And also, the above figure there shows the Bergaholm catchment, wetland, sorry. And the overall, this was a 2-year period, the overall retention was 36%. And mostly particulate phosphorus, plus even some dissolved reactive phosphorus. I think it was 9%. But you can also see those small blips when we have negative retention, which shows that when we have high flow rates, the wetland could actually act as the source of phosphorus rather than a sink. And that's even more obvious in the lower figure, which is another wetland where we had very large negative retention events, where the wetland acted as a source rather than a sink for phosphorus. This shows the initial phases of a wetland. What happens during after 10 years, and how often do we have to empty them, take away the sediments and spread it out on arable land and so forth. That's for us unknown still. Leaving the water flow and getting more into the source, something that has been tested within this program is catch crops, or I guess you say cover crops. This has been tested in Sweden for a number of years to reduce nitrate leaching, and it's been shown to be extremely effective. You can reduce nitrate leaching by 50% easily. But it has been much less investigated when it comes to phosphorus. And this was included in this program. And we did it with in an experiment where we used two soils, one sand and one clay, on which we applied cover crop residues, just to see what happens when you have cover crop residues on the soil during winter, when you have freeze-thaw cycles and so forth. We had four cover crops, catch crops. It was perennial ryegrass, chicory, honey herb, and oilseed radish. You see the rainfall simulator to the right. We put them in the rainfall simulator four times, and we applied 5 millimeters during 10 hours, so 50 millimeters per event. And in between, we had a freezing event. So there were freezing-thawing event. So in total, there were four irrigation events and three freezing-thawing events. And this is basically what happens. We also had an experiment, I should say, the green bars here, where we didn't have any soil. We just exposed the plant material to exactly the same treatment, this irrigation followed by freezing and thawing without the soil. And as you can see to the right, it was a control, and these are just two of the four catch crops, ryegrass and chicory. Without the plant material, we had quite low losses, or in fact very low losses. When we added the plant material, the losses significantly increased, and it was basically in the clay soil that it increased. If you look at the control there, you had higher losses in the sandy soil. And that's basically because we had obviously a lot of dissolved reactive phosphorus leaching through macropores in the clay. That's the interpretation that we did. But you can also see that the plant material in itself exposed to freezing thawing cycles, the ryegrass was 10 kilophosphorus, the chicory was 50 kilophosphorus. So in fact, the soil really acts as a filter for phosphorus in this case, even though it increases compared to a no crop at all. Something also related to crop residues, those buffer strips that we have been tested, but they have not been very successful. And I think the main reason is, as I said, I mean, we have pretty flat land and relatively low intensity rainfall. So and also during snow melt, the intensity in the water flow is so intense, so it won't just float over the buffer strip. It would basically take, it's like digging a ditch, like I saw like I showed in a previous slide. But also here we have to be aware of the fact that we have crop residues, or a crop is usually ryegrass, exposed to freezing thawing, and that would release dissolved reactive phosphorus that can eventually leach or run off into the ditch. So I think that mitigation strategy here would be definitely to harvest the buffer strip crop before winter, basically, so you don't have a lot of plant material lying on the soil. There has been a lot of experiments in other countries than Sweden where this has been tested in Norway and Finland, for example. Jan this morning talked about regulations in when we talk about manure. And as he said, it's heavily regulated. You cannot spread manure on frozen ground in nitrate vulnerable zones from, I think it's the 1st of November till the 28th of February. In other areas from the 1st of December to the 28th of February. And in the latter case, if you spread it in the winter, you have to incorporate it within 12 hours. And that's, of course, put a lot of... you need enough storage to avoid this. And I think the storage has to be 6 to 8 months. You mentioned 6 to 10 months. And I think the regulations change so quickly. So you might be correct with 10 months. But it depends on where the farm is located, and it also depends on the number of animals you have. So I basically focused on problems with mitigation strategies, whether you have high flow rates or you apply your crop residues on frozen ground, and that will be exposed to freezing thawing cycles. But there are certainly also mitigation strategies that have a positive effect. And structured liming has been tested quite heavily, and that's been structured liming is not a common practice here, is it? It's been extremely common in Sweden the last few years. What it basically boils down to is applying calcium hydroxide, calcium oxide or calcium carbonate or mixtures of them at the rate of about 5 to 6 tons per hectare and thereby improve on clay soils, of course, and thereby improve soil structure and thereby reduce phosphorus losses. It's been tested during relatively short periods and whether these effects are good after 3 years, we don't really know. So that has to be definitely tested further. And we also have, there are a couple of sites that have been tested on, but I think we need to do it on more soils, for example. But it's one of those methods that's been very accepted by farmers. It's relatively inexpensive. It can improve the soil structure. It can have yield benefits and so forth. So it definitely is accepted by farmers. I think I stopped there anyway.
Thank you. Do we have time for one or two questions for Lars? Come on, you can all the way from Sweden. Deanna's got one.
Okay.
So I thought it was really exciting that you were able to do such a large experiment and look at so many different factors.
Yes. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last part.
What are the top three practices?
Top three. Well, as I said, structured liming would probably be. It's not fully known all the odds and ends, but I think that would be one of them. I think catch crops is out. We already because when it's exposed to freezing thawing. It's more of a source than a sink for phosphorus, basically, in Sweden. Buffer strips also. I don't think buffer strips is a big thing, and it will never be. Constructed wetlands, if you have the place for them, a lot of these wetlands, buffer strips, catch crops, and structure liming all get subsidies. The farmer can get subsidies from the rural development program, so that's definitely an incentive to carry them out, obviously. But I think structure liming and constructed wetlands would be my choice.
Okay, great, thank you.
Okay, we're gonna have to cut it off there.
Thank you, Lars.